Barnhart Glass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Here we are on October 9, 2012. And I wanted to let you know that during the month of October, which is Vegetarian Awareness Month and a lot of other things, it's also the fundraising month for Responsible Eating and Living, the nonprofit that I founded. And I just wanted to let you know about it. Visit the website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. You can go to the donate button and read our real appeal and find out what we're up to and how you can help. Also, you can send me an email anytime at info@realmeals.org. Okay? Now let's get to the program today. We have a couple of great guests, and I wanted to start with our first, John Robbins. Groomed to follow in the footsteps of his father, he chose a different path for himself, becoming a social activist and fierce advocate for plant-strong diets and compassionate living. John Robbins is the author of The Food Revolution, Diet for a New America, Reclaiming Our Health, Healthy at 100, and The New Good Life. His life and work has been featured on PBS special, Diet for a New America, and he has won numerous awards for his pioneering work, including the Rachel Carson Award, the Albert Schweitzer Humanitarian Award, the Peace Abbey's Courage of Conscience Award, and Green America's Lifetime Achievement Award. He lives with his family in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and we're going to talk about his newest book, No Happy Cows. Hi, John.
Hi, Karen. Glad to be here with you.
Yes, I'm glad to hear your voice. Okay, so let's talk about this latest book. You know, one of the things that I love about your writing is you can talk about some of the worst horrific things that are going on this planet today, and yet you do it in a voice that is so inviting and so calming and so full of compassion. It's, I don't know how you do it.
Well, I think I learned that when you shut your eyes to reality, you invite destruction. And we have to somehow find a way to keep our eyes and hearts open to the anguish that's taking place in our world if we're going to respond to it in a healthy way, in a positive way, in a productive way. And if we don't do that, if we go into denial and just shut down in the face of things, it's tempting to do that, but we collapse, and it's really not acceptance, it's resignation, and we become diminished, and we aren't able to respond. And I think there is in each of us a desire, actually, to somehow use the suffering and use the difficulties that are part of our world and part of our lives to become stronger people and become capable of resilience and creativity in reply to what goes on that needs to be changed. And I'm here really to support people in finding ways to transform the anguish, the difficulty, the suffering into positive action.
Well, you've been very good at that, and I don't even know if you have the idea of how many people you have actually touched and how many seeds you have planted to do this positive action. Throughout history, there have been people that have been speaking out about what humans do to other humans and to other life on Earth. There have always been these great humanitarians risking all kinds of things just to get this information out. And I think in our decade or our century, you are definitely one of those people that they will write about in the future, about really stepping up and spreading this message in such a powerful way. So,
well, thank you, Karen.
Thank you
know,
for that.
I do agree with you that down through history there have been people who have spoken for and represented the oneness of life, the interdependence of life, that we aren't so separate and divided from one another as we are often taught to think. But I think now the survival of our civilization it depends on not just a few people being spokespersons for our interconnectedness, but a lot of us realizing that is a central fact of our lives, and finding ways to act so that awareness can spread and develop and emerge into ever more people. It really needs to become the central organizing force of our society.
Let's talk a little bit about No Happy Cows. I think everyone should pick this book up. It's really easy to read. It's got lots of different articles in here, but they really get to the core of what's going on in the world today. So the first thing I want to talk about, when a lot of people talk about eating plant foods versus animal foods, the old-fashioned question has been forever, you know, where do you get your protein? But there have been other questions that have popped up since then, and a big one is this controversy around soy. And you really did a pretty good job of analyzing soy. And I thought we might talk a little bit about that. Why has soy become such a demon food in some people's minds?
Well, you know, it has been demonized, and there are people who, of course, are allergic to it, but there are a few. That isn't very many. What actually has happened is two things. That it has made soy problematic. One is that almost the entire soy crop in the United States today is genetically engineered. It's Monsanto's Roundup Ready soybeans. If you're going to buy a soy product, tofu, soy milk, whatever, you need to get it organic, or else it's going to be, without being labeled as such, but it will be genetically engineered. The extent to which our soy crop has become genetically engineered is just overwhelming, other than the organic. So people are having reactions to soy products they didn't used to have. The truth is, it's not so much the soybean itself, it's what we've done in genetically modifying the soybean that is creating these many-fold kinds of disturbances. Secondly, as if that weren't enough, we've isolated the soybean. We're processing it in all kinds of ways, and we're isolating the protein, and we're texturizing it, and we're doing things to it, and we're taking the oil out of it, and we're processing that oil, and we're refining that oil and putting it into things. And it's a cheap product. It's subsidized by the government because most of our soy crop goes to livestock feed. So it's heavily subsidized by those interests that want the meat industry and the dairy industry to be able to buy cheap feed, namely cheap soy. So it becomes very cheap, and it's used all over the place, and it's isolated. All our processed foods are full of isolated, processed, genetically modified soy ingredients. And people are having reactions to this.
Yes.
People are having responses in their digestive tract, in their immune system, in their respiratory system. They're having autoimmune responses. It is creating havoc.
It's hard to pinpoint the one thing because people eat so many different things that have all kinds of manufactured foods in them.
It's very hard. But the fact remains that organic whole soy products are fine. Yeah, you don't want to eat nothing but them. You'd be an idiot to eat nothing but broccoli. But soy is a healthy food. And for most of us, a shift from meats and dairy products and eggs as our primary source of protein, instead to plant proteins, including soy, organic soy products, is one of the healthiest steps we can take. So the demonization of soy has some grounds. But there's a way to circumvent the difficulties, and that is to buy organic soy and to buy whole soy products. And then you don't subject yourself to those problems.
There's so many things that are going on that really make people very confused and concerned about our food system and how it's connected to lobbyists and corporate interests and not our own personal health. I just wonder, how is it we were fortunate enough to get the organic certification? And people argue that there are problems with that, too. But at least we know if something has the organic certification label that it's not genetically modified. We got one little label in there.
Yes, and we got that because a lot of people worked very, very, very hard for that. And there's been efforts to dilute it, to water it down, to erode it, to include as organic things like sewage sludge, genetically engineered ingredients, irradiated foods. those efforts, though, to water it down and let those kinds of things be included as organic have been defeated by the efforts of groups like the Organic Consumers Association and a lot of people who've worked really hard. You know, we can sometimes. I mean, our political system is quite broken. We all know that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, frankly, when I listen to our politicians, I feel like I need to take a shower afterwards. it's really
if you haven't
polluted,
fallen asleep first, yeah.
Yeah, it's the level of truth isn't very high usually, and yet we still it's the only political process we have. And it can, when enough of us work hard on it, we can get some things done. And we did in the case that you're referring to. And we do have an organic standards board, and we do have organic standards and certification. And it means something. It's got teeth, and we can trust it.
So speaking of demons, you talk about the monster Monsanto a number of times in your book. And there's this proposition in California, number 37, which will go to the ballots in November, about genetically modified labeling, and you're in California. How is that going so far?
Karen, I am traveling all over the state. I'm driving, flying all over the state these days, doing fundraisers and events for Proposition 37. It is leading in the polls right now. Unfortunately, the LA Times came out yesterday against it. The Grocery Manufacturers Association, which sells a lot of processed foods, put a lot of pressure on the Times. They're their biggest, they represent their biggest advertisers. So money talks. The Monsanto is pouring money into this, as is the Biotech Industry Organization, as is Pepsi and Coke. These companies that use high fructose corn syrup that's made from genetically modified corn, and other sweeteners made from genetically modified corn, they don't want to disclose. They don't want people to know which foods are in fact genetically modified. They don't want labeling. So the money is very. They're outspending us about 20-1, 30-1, and yet the polls show it passing still. So it's going to be a fight. I think it has a very good chance. And really, what it comes down to is the right to know. We're not trying to outlaw genetically modified.
That's right.
We're just trying to give consumers the right to know which foods are or which foods aren't genetically modified. And in this case, I don't think ignorance is bliss. I think ignorance is subordination.
Mm-hmm.
It's subservience to Monsanto's plan to control the food supply without anybody raising a finger or raising an eyebrow or certainly preventing their efforts from succeeding. They want to profit and exploit the food supply, and they're doing so, and this is a way to stop them. They know that. Monsanto is really a terrible company, and I'll just give one example of how they fight public awareness. When the first genetically engineered product to enter the human food supply was Monsanto's bovine growth hormone,
mm-hmm.
a genetically engineered hormone that they sold to dairies, large dairies, who would inject it, and still do in many cases, inject it into the dairy cows, and the result is that the cows give a lot more milk. Their udders get quite enlarged. Some of them almost drag on the ground. They get distended, and they get full of pus. They get mastitis, inevitably, which is an udder infection. It is so predictable that cows injected with the bovine growth hormone will get mastitis that when Monsanto delivers the genetically engineered hormone to the dairies, in the same package comes the antibiotics Monsanto also makes to treat the mastitis, which invariably the cows develop. It makes them sick, and then residues from those drugs end up in milk, pus ends up in the milk, and possibly even more significantly, antibiotic-resistant bacteria end up in the milk. And this is undermining our medicines. There's a lot of reasons to not use this hormone in dairy production. But what happened was when Monsanto introduced this product and got the larger dairies to use it, some smaller dairies refused to do so. And they put on their labels accurately, not made with bovine growth hormone.
Right.
Or BGH-free, or different phrases that accurately told the public that their cheese or their yogurt or their ice cream wasn't made from milk from cows who'd been injected with the Monsanto's hormone. Monsanto then sued these dairies for the crime of informing the public accurately that they weren't using the product on the ground that by labeling their products accurately as not using Monsanto's product, they were unfairly stigmatizing Monsanto's product. And although that may seem like a ludicrous and absurd argument, Monsanto is so big, and they're such thugs, honestly, that they'd bully and intimidate these dairies, and the dairies would go out of business trying to fight the Monsanto's legal machine.
And Monsanto always wins.
Monsanto would win because they're so big and and financially powerful. And so they fought the right to know by literally exterminating those small dairies that tried to do things in a natural way and to let the people, the public, know that they were doing that. That they've stopped suing dairies now because there are just so many doing it. But it just is an example of how committed they are to fighting our right to know. And then the current example, of course, is the California proposition. Earlier this year, both Vermont and Connecticut came within a hair's breadth of passing legislation and putting it into effect that would have mandated labeling of GMOs in their states. In both cases, though, Monsanto threatened to sue the states, the state of Vermont and the state of Connecticut. And in one case, it was the governor. In the other case, it was a key representative on the committee. And they backed down. They didn't want to saddle the citizens of those states with the legal bills that would be required to go up.
It's just Vermont, amazing how they get away with it.
Yeah, they actually intimidated states. Now, Vermont and Connecticut are small, relatively speaking. California, though, the size of California's economy is massive compared to either of those states, and that is not a tactic that Monsanto can get away with in the case of California. And California also, interestingly, is one of the states, one of the remaining states, that has this ballot initiative process, which can be misused, but in this case, it's the right use of it. And if it passes, and we'll know it's on November 6th, that's the date, and I'm working my butt off, Karen, actually, every day these months, if we can get this passed. If it does pass, it's going to set a precedent for the country.
Absolutely.
California's economy is so big that it could spread through the whole...
So much of our food comes from California.
That's right. That's right. And they can't... The implication, that's why Monsanto is spending tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Right. This.
Crazy. Really crazy. Well, that's humans for you. We, I want to believe, like you said earlier, that we all have it within us to do positive action, but many, many live in denial. And somehow that drug of money can influence so many people in not very nice ways. The other, there's all the stories, all the articles are very good in here. One of them that really got me is the chocolate story. And I remember when you first wrote about slavery and chocolate, maybe a decade ago, I'm not sure how long ago it was, but I was not happy to read the updates.
I know. Well, there's a more recent update that you will be happy
with. Oh, good. I need some good news.
Just this week, just a couple of days ago, actually, Hershey's finally agreed to end slavery in their, not by cocoa from the African fields where child slaves are used. And Hershey's has been the last big chocolate company to hold out against this. And it's actually a really big deal that they have finally agreed. Now, we're going to have to keep them, you know, we're going to have to watch over them and make sure that they keep their word. But the fact that they've made the commitment, up until now they've refused. People may not realize what we're talking about. I'll just say briefly that a great deal, about 40% of the world's cocoa, comes from the Ivory Coast. It's an African nation where it's a very poor nation and unfortunately, tragically, a tremendous amount of child slaves are actually used in the cocoa fields there. They're abducted from their homes in adjacent countries or stolen or in some cases purchased. There's promises made to their families that are not even remotely what actually takes place. It's a long, sordid, ugly, brutal story of children being not just mistreated and abused, but literally enslaved and even killed in the production of chocolate, this food that we associate with pleasure and happiness.
Yeah.
It's one of these just tragedies that's taking place on our planet today. But there's been a lot of us trying to expose this and educate people, and particularly get the large cocoa companies in this country to stop sourcing there, to use their buying clout to eliminate this practice. And we've been working at this for many, many years, and we've gotten some headway. And Hershey's was the most intractable company for whatever reason. They just wouldn't.
Yeah,
it's
mind blowing to me, especially the people in the top positions who clearly are affluent and have power. How they can support something like this?
They see things so strictly through the balance sheet, and they justify it that it's their fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. The profit is what they're in business to produce, and they don't look at the larger bottom line of the impact on the world. But when their own shareholders start to demand change, and they fight it, well, who are they fighting it on whose behalf at that point? The shareholders are demanding the change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've done with Hershey's, and we finally got a shift here. So,
oh, that's really good news. You know, I have so many memories about Hershey's, and, of course, I haven't had any Hershey's chocolate in a very long time, But as a kid, you know, Halloween's coming up, and when we got a Hershey bar in our trick-or-treat bag, that was a major score. That was
yes.
The best thing you could get. And then my parents took us for a trip to Lancaster County, and the Hershey factory is there.
Yeah.
And it was so delightful to see these giant vats of gooey, luscious chocolate just churning away, and the little soldiers of candy kisses, just lovely memories, and to know that that's all sprinkled with just pain and suffering of children.
I know. Well, you know, I love dark chocolate in moderate amounts, but I get it organic.
Yeah.
By the way, if it's organic, you know that it's not slave produced in any way.
That's good news.
Yeah, and I also get fair trade chocolate when I can, and I get because that's an additional positive thing. But organic, simply getting it organic means that it won't be tainted by slavery, and. And dark chocolate has many wonderful nutrients and nutritional benefits. You got to be careful though, because as the chocolate gets more and more sugar in it and more fat added, and certainly if you get milk chocolate, you have dairy products added that aren't good. But dark chocolate, a high percentage of it being dark, and the small amounts, you know, it's. See, that's an indulgence
mm-hmm.
That I permit myself and enjoy.
And we all should.
We need to have healthy pleasures.
Absolutely.
I think we need to have pleasures and things that enrich our lives that don't destroy us, don't impair our ability to live with power and resilience and creativity and joy, and don't have impacts. You know, their production systems aren't exploiting the world, aren't damaging the environment, aren't harming people. Aren't brutalizing animals. You know, we can have healthy pleasures that are produced in a way that's in harmony and with respect for life, and that's where we need to go.
Tell me about the Food Revolution Network.
Well, that's a powerful thing. We have over 35,000 members now. It's something that my son Ocean and I have created together, and we're doing a lot of events. People can learn about it at foodrevolution.org. foodrevolution.org, and we're doing some remarkable things. We've had 12 different New York Times number one best-selling authors that I've interviewed in the last little while. We had a summit where we had over 35,000 participants.
Mm.
we're basically trying to spread the word about what a healthy diet really is, and how if you get more and more of your nutrients, your protein, your fats, your carbs, and all your phytochemicals and vitamins and antioxidants and all the wonderful things that foods can give you to make your life healthy and good, from plants instead of animals, very often the health-giving properties are enhanced, the negative properties are diminished, the environmental effects are much more positive, there isn't the cruelty that's involved in modern meat production, and there's just so many benefits to moving to a plant-strong diet. And you feel better, you're leaner, we reduce our risks of heart disease and cancer and diabetes and obesity and so many of the other problems, dementia and the other problems that plague our society today. And we feel better, and we're stronger, and our minds are clearer, our emotions are more serene and workable. And instead of our bodies being something we drag through life, they become ways that we express ourselves and fountains of understanding of one another. There's a possibility for empathy that can grow that I think actually, and higher consciousness, frankly, mm-hmm. on a strong diet, mm-hmm. that this is one of the secrets, so people don't talk about it, but I occasionally do. When you start eating a plant-strong diet and get away from these fats, these animal fats that clog up your bloodstream and weigh you down, what happens is your mind becomes sharper and more lucid, and your energy goes to a higher frequency, and your ability to empathize and connect with other people and other beings increases. And what happens through all of this is your engagement with life goes to another level, and you become actually a more conscious person, a more awake, more aware person. And I think that for a lot of us, that's part of the purpose of life. That's really what is fulfilling and joyful.
We don't know how good I like to tell people they don't know how good they can feel simply
exactly.
by just changing what they eat. They don't even know.
I know. It's so true. It is. They don't know, and they don't find out. It's so frustrating when they won't find out because they won't make the shift to just experiment, to try it for a while and see if it works for you and see what it does for you and see what you might gain from it. Entrenched interests that keep us believing we must eat animal protein at mm-hmm. every meal to be healthy, there's no scientific grounds for that. It's just marketing. It's just the entrenched interests of industry. And we need deeply, as acts of liberation for ourselves, to extricate ourselves from that captivity and become free people.
It's happening in the United States. I'm very thankful for the internet because that's the way this message is getting out at an exponential level. More people are catching on. The thing is, it's not catching on really outside of the United States. Certainly in Europe, there's a lot going on. But we see as the developing nations become more affluent, they're starting from a point where we were a long time ago. They're not using the most state-of-the-art information.
I know, it's sad. They're following in our
mistakes.
On this path of destruction. Just to give one example that I'm very familiar with, Baskin-Robbins now has more stores in Tokyo than it does in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
which is where it originated.
And when were Asians eating dairy?
Exactly. It's not part of their traditional cuisine. And in fact, most Asians are lactose intolerant.
Yeah.
It's not part of the foods supplies that they grew up with and that they've evolved with at all, and they get all kinds of health problems as a result, but they like the taste. Right now, KFC is making more money in China than it makes in the United States.
Wow.
All of these fast food enterprises, Taco Bell, KFC, McDonald's, Burger King, Baskin Robbins, all of them are going to Asia because there's a huge market there, and they're advertising is massive. I am interviewed often by publications in those countries who are trying to raise awareness. Please, and I say to the people, look, as an American, as a member of the Baskin-Robbins family even, I implore you, don't buy Baskin-Robbins, don't buy any ice cream, don't feed it to your kids, because it will make them sick and fat, It'll make them unhealthy. It'll undermine the beauty of their lives, and it will reduce their self-esteem, and it will make life harder for them. And it's not worth it for the pleasure, the momentary pleasure of eating that dessert.
And there are so many other wonderful plant-based desserts out there that make great treats that aren't doing the harm on the planet or the harm to our bodies.
There really are, and even ice cream in particular, if you're an ice cream junkie, and I was one. It's been a long time, but I was, and probably to a level that most people wouldn't even be able to grasp. But I did eat ice cream for breakfast growing up. But there are many frozen desserts now that are made without dairy, some of them are coconut milk based or soy based or almond milk based, and they're so much better for you. And they don't have the dairy protein, so they don't have the allergenic responses that you get to dairy proteins. They don't have the saturated fats and the types that are in dairy that cause so much trouble. They're really better for you. They don't involve this cruelty to dairy cows and to veal calves and so forth that is implicit in modern factory dairy production, industrial dairy production. So there are so many advantages to them. And frankly, when you make the shift, they taste better.
That's right. And I hear that all the time. My friends that are moving to more plants, less animals, they talk to me and tell me how foods that they used to love, when they try them again as a treat or something, they don't feel good, they don't taste as good. We could talk about this all day, John, and I usually do, but it's the end of this segment, and I wanted to thank you for joining me, and it's all about food. Everybody go and get no happy cows. Let's make all the cows on this planet happy.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. We're going to take a very quick break, and in a minute we'll be back with Mark Reinfeld and the Taste of Europe. Hello there, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food on October 9, 2012. How are you today? I'm doing pretty well. It's that autumn thing going on here in New York, and it's beautiful. It's a little wet, but we like it. I wanted to mention again that it's time for The Real Appeal, Responsible Eating and Living, the nonprofit that I founded just a little more than a year ago, is having its fundraising month where we ask all of our supporters to help us out a little bit so that we can keep doing what we're doing. We've got lots of great videos, food shows, travel shows, all kinds of recipes. We keep adding new recipes almost daily. Lots of wonderful information up there, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Please visit, and visit often. Okay, do you know that according to LA Weekly, it's an article that just came out, it's calling 2012 the year of vegan cookbooks. And we just heard recently that vegan is mainstream in Los Angeles. This is all really, really good news. And the good news is the food is incredible, and it's just getting more and more incredible because we have great people coming up with great recipes, restaurants, cookbooks, etc. And now I'm going to be talking with Mark Reinfeld, who is the winner of Vegan.com's Recipe of the Year Award for 2011. He is the founding chef of the celebrated Blossoming Lotus Restaurant and is the award-winning author of Vegan Fusion World Cuisine and the co-author of The 30-Minute Vegan and The 30-Minute Vegan's Taste of the East. Welcome to It's All About Food, Mark.
Hey, Karen. Thank you so much for having me here.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for writing your latest cookbook, Taste of Europe.
Well, it was a joy to write it, so thanks for picking it up.
Yeah. I don't know about everyone, but I have my romance with Europe. I lived in the south of France for 4 years. I've traveled all over, and I love it there.
Yeah, it definitely strikes a chord in most of us here in America to go back to the old country.
And it always disturbs me a little bit when our American culture kind of gets in a little too much over there, because I really love the way some of the countries live to some extent. The architecture in many places is beautiful. The way they take their time, that whole slow food movement thing, making food beautiful, really caring about quality ingredients, I don't want to lose that.
Yeah, it's a very special place, and it's really good to experience it. So when you come back here, you could bring a little bit of it back into your everyday life.
And the great thing is that it can all be vegan.
Amen.
So
it's surprising that now, like you mentioned, the year of the vegan cookbooks, it's just incredible how easy it is to create pretty much the full array of world cuisine in a world-class way that's using all plant-based products.
You know what, I'm just thinking of this right now, but it's sort of coming around full circle where when people were starting eating vegetarian, we looked towards ethnic foods because there were a lot of other countries that ate primarily plant-based, although they would add small amounts of meat or fish. But the food wasn't incredibly interesting. And now we've kind of come all the way around and we're going back to all of those international cuisines outside of the United States and finding out how to do their best dishes vegan.
Yeah, I fully agree that if you do look at most indigenous cultures, that there essentially were a majority of the diets were plant-based and the animal products were more as a condiment. And so we go a step further and just show how the full spectrum of cuisine can be created with plant-based. And I love to use a lot of the ingredients that are local to the different countries and all the fresh herbs and vegetables that most of us are familiar with, and just combine them in a way to recreate these European classic dishes.
I want to talk about the challenge of promoting the vegan diet and promoting vegan food. Specifically, I think it's not just about presenting beautiful dishes and making varied dishes and making them taste good, but people that are coming to this diet are coming to it more for not just for tasty food. They're coming to it because they want to be healthy, they want to feel good. Some people have allergies. There's all these different issues, and it seems more of the cookbooks that I'm reading are taking all of these things into consideration. And in some ways, I don't want to say apologetically, it's just there are so many more parameters to keep in mind, not just taking out animal food, because the people that are attracted to these types of cookbooks are far more savvy about what they want in their food.
I feel that it's really a whole, this is like the whole being diet. It's where you're looking at not only satisfying all the tastes and flavors that you're looking for, but also having it nourish you on all these additional levels. So this kind of food is good for you, and it's also good for the planet. So you could, like John was mentioning, there's benefit upon benefit. There's the flavor that's amazing, and then you start looking at the health benefits, which are incredible, and then you see the ripple effect out into the environment and also just creating a more peaceful world here by relying on plants instead of animals for our sustenance.
I want to delve into the cookbook a little bit, but before I do, I wanted to ask you a few more questions. You did the food for Summerfest this summer?
I did. That was definitely one of the highlights of my culinary career. One of the largest vegetarian conferences in the world. It's a 5-day event held annually in Johnson, Pennsylvania. And it was three meals a day for over 700 to 800 people a day. So it was definitely a large scale operation.
I haven't been there in a few years, but one of the things that I noticed was the people attending were very particular about their food. They knew what they wanted, and they wanted a lot of it. These vegans could mow.
Yeah, it was definitely a discriminating crowd, to say the least. We had a we had a gluten-free station, a raw station, an oil-free station, a pizza station, a hot bar, two salad bars. It was full on.
Mm-hmm. So that's part of what I was talking about with the challenges, because there are people that are looking for more than just food without animal products. Some want oil-free, some want salt-free, some want wheat-free, and it's quite a plate.
It's surprisingly easy. That's what the approach that I like to take is. I see myself as someone that really helps demystify the art of vegan food preparation. So many, more and more people are learning about vegan foods, what they are and what their benefits are, and I feel like my role is to demystify the how-to part through the cookbooks I write, and also I offer workshops and trainings around the country to just show people how easy it is to accommodate any dietary need that they might have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's go to Europe. And
let's go.
Let's go. I want to go. So you start out talking about Italian food, then we go to France, we go to Spain, and then United Kingdom and Ireland and Germany and then a bunch of other countries, and everything is really incredible. So there's certainly a lot of Italian food in here because they do make a lot of plant-based options naturally.
Yeah, that was I've done quite a bit of travel in Europe that began over 20 years ago, and I find that Italy was definitely one of the most vegan-friendly places to be. Well, and just, it was naturally a reliance on a lot of fresh vegetables and fresh herbs and just sauces for various pastas that were vegetable-based.
So here's a kind of bizarre way that I looked at food around Europe. I used to work as an engineer in the semiconductor industry. I did a lot of traveling, and I would visit different customer sites in different countries, in Italy, in France, in Scotland, and Germany, if I can remember all the places I've been. But the thing that stood out to me was the cafeteria food in the Italian companies was incredible, and it was so above and beyond everywhere else. So the tables would have mineral water and olive oil every table, and then the standard fare you could always get, this wasn't even the main entree of the day, but they would have shelves of room temperature grilled vegetables, the antipasto, so you could get eggplant or zucchini or just lovely grilled plain vegetables. They always had several sauces, like a marinara and something else. They always had plain rice and a pasta. It was beautiful, and it was real.
That's one thing you see as the cultural role that food plays also, and the emphasis on, like you mentioned earlier, about the slow food movement and just really taking the time to appreciate the gift that food is for us, and to really celebrate and honor the ritual of it, and really put a lot of mindfulness into it.
And then I have a specific romance with France because I lived in the south of France for 4 years, and there's just some things. I learned so much there. I was a vegan when I lived there, and I learned a lot about food, not from eating it, just from looking at it, because I didn't eat much of the things that they served.
Yeah.
But the presentation.
Yeah, the markets and the gardens, and then another emphasis is the daily. If you notice, like, the refrigerators are usually a lot smaller over there, and it's because they're making these daily or every other day trips to the markets or little specialty stores to keep things fresh.
And people just seemed, it was just so, I don't know a better word than romantic. It was just so lovely, the care. I would have a friend, for example, she would just wrap up a little sachet of lavender for me just as a little gift. And then the tisanes, people would be drinking just a light tea sometimes with thyme. So simple.
Right. Yep.
Anyway,
it's a beautiful
and, you know,
thing to experience.
And you mentioned the cliche of a woman walking with a baguette. You see that all the time still today. They people
it's,
go
yeah,
to the bakery.
Yeah, the past definitely comes alive mm-hmm. over there. It's really an amazing experience just because there's a it's still a Western culture, which there's well, I love world travel. I've been traveling for over 20 years and going to other Western nations. There's still a lot of similarities, and yet you see these little differences that make a big impact on the quality of the day.
Right. I just want to underline what you just said because it really is important. These places, they're like states in the United States. They're not large.
Right.
And yet they really have very unique different flavors and styles and presentation, and I just want to keep that. We just have a
right.
few more minutes. I wanted to touch on, I appreciate you wrote in the Spain section. Now, I haven't been to Spain very often, but I always had a terrible time eating there. I spent a lot of the 90s in Europe, and I know things have really changed in the last 10 years with vegetarian and vegan food all over Europe. But you talk about being aware of a Spanish tortilla is really an omelet with eggs in it. I didn't know that.
Really, yeah, that's a subtle, well, not so subtle surprise if you order a tortilla and you get scrambled, you know, an omelet instead of what we're accustomed to.
Mm-hmm. And you have a recipe for bangers and mash, which is pretty popular in, I've seen it in Scotland, actually, and I had a vegan version when I was in Edinburgh once.
Right, that's with mashed potatoes, and I use vegan sausage, and then this really nice gravy that is served, and it's, again, the effort was to do a full spectrum of recipes that touch on a lot of the classics that people are familiar with, as well as introducing new recipes that just utilize the regional ingredients.
Right. There's just so many really yummy things in here that I really am looking forward to trying. You know, nobody can say that vegan food is boring.
No, I also give out free recipes on our website for people that want to check that out as well. We have a newsletter where I send out free recipes and more info on the vegan lifestyle and classes and workshops and things like that.
And what's
just
that website?
To demonstrate.
That's veganfusion.com?
Yeah, it's at veganfusion.com. And just in keeping with what John was saying, just really emphasizing the imperative nature of looking at how we grow food and what we're eating as a way to really affect incredible positive change on the planet. So, again, my role is to help show people how amazing the food could taste, and if people are looking for a virtual tour of Europe, they'll find it in the recipes of Taste of Europe.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You have some praise at the beginning of your cookbook, and I just wanted to ask, is Cher a vegan?
I am not sure of what her current lifestyle choice is, but I did a couple of private chef gigs for her in California. A very amazing woman.
Wow. Good for you. Mm-hmm. Seems
that
like
was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've been all around. You know, I spent a little time in Germany, and I was in Munich, but in a very small part of Munich, and I was near a small market, not where any of the major ones were, and I practically lived on cabbage, potatoes, and onions for 2 months.
Mm. Right. Germany was more of the challenging, one of the more challenging countries to come up with recipes, though, again, with how vegan analog products have come so far that you can, there are these meat alternatives that are not necessarily health foods, but helpful in people transitioning away from animal products. So I like to, there's a lot of wurst, like bratwurst, and I like to say that it's the aptly named wurst, because they're really not very good for you, those products. So the plant-based alternatives are a lot better way to go.
And the other thing is beer. I love to see that you use beer in some of your recipes. I like cooking sometimes with beer and wine, especially if I want to keep something oil-free.
Yeah, I enjoyed working with the various beers and wines in this book, and one of my former chef at the Lotus and close friend Patrick Bremser did a full section on wine and beer pairing for vegan foods, which is an interesting topic in itself.
Can you talk a little bit about when you give a training class, what that's like?
Sure. I love showing people how easy it is to create these world-class meals, and lately I do weekend workshops and 10-day trainings in Hawaii and on the West Coast, and I have some events planned on the East Coast and in Europe as well. And basically it's like whatever your skill or confidence level is, I can show you these really simple techniques that are very empowering for people, so that they find, even after a 10-day training, that their skill level and confidence level has just gone to totally new levels. It's amazing to watch the transformation in people, feeling that they could take their health back into their own hands and prepare these life-giving foods for themselves and their family.
Yeah, I'm always telling people to find their kitchens. We all
right,
have,
that's a most, good place to start.
I mean,
well,
most of us have
the,
them, but don't
yeah,
use them very often.
You see the role that food plays, especially when you travel, that it really is one of the main things that unites humanity is food and the ritual of eating. And so my feeling is that if we could bring consciousness and awareness into how we partake of that fundamental human activity, that it will have this ripple effect into all other aspects of our lives.
I like that. I like that very much.
Yeah.
So what's next for you? Are you going to another continent?
I actually have an event planned in Belize in December. I do these vegan culinary tours where I go with small groups of people and we experience the local culture and prepare foods together. So Belize is coming up in December, and then I'll be returning to Europe next summer. And also I'm working on the next 30-minute vegan books, which will be 30-minute vegan soups and stews, which will have over 125 recipes from around the world of different soups and stews and condiments that go with them.
Now let's just talk about the 30-minute vegan concept just for 30 seconds.
Okay.
I know people have very busy lives, and they're kind of daunted by cooking because they think it takes a long time. And so there are a number of cookbooks today that want to stress that it's quick to make most of these meals. And to some extent, when you have a skill, you can put a meal together relatively quickly. But
that was the guiding principle for coming up with this, the idea of the 30-minute vegan. Most people can wrap their mind around spending a half hour getting a meal together. So I just designed the recipes in a way that really goes back to like these simple basic techniques that create a lot of flavor but don't take too much time in the kitchen. So virtually all the recipes, you can create these gourmet quality meals in less than 30 minutes.
It's good, but people still have to get their feet wet, and there's a certain amount of organization involved. You talk a little bit about it in your book. People have to be thinking ahead, because you can't just open the book and get started. Most people, if they're just new to this, they don't have any of the right ingredients in their refrigerator or in their cupboards, and they may not have the right tools. In everything in life, it takes organization,
it takes planning. Baby steps, and I think the first thing is just a willingness and an awareness that it's a direction that you want to go in your life. And then it's really, I guess, if I had to sum it up, I would say it's like it's a lot simpler than people think it is.
Mark, I wanted to thank you. We're at the end of the program, and I want to thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. I said I was living in the south of France earlier, and one of the things that I loved was the fields where all of the herbs would just grow naturally, and you could walk through them, and the sun would bake on them, and the fragrance was just intoxicating. And so I thought, Just as a nice way to end the show, I've done quite a bit of singing, and I have a piece that is going to play from a French composer, Duparc, who wrote a song called Fidèle, and it talks in French just about those things, about the clover and the thyme and the sunlight and the warm fragrance around the paths. And so that's how we're going to end the show today. Thank you for joining me, Mark Reinfeld. Taste of Europe. Go to veganfusion.com. And I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.